Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on a special Halloween episode of Journal Club, I am joined by three retina specialists to discuss four recent publications in major ophthalmology journals. First, we discuss a retrospective look at online patient reviews for ophthalmologists in major metropolitan areas. Next, we discuss a study looking at the reliability of systematic reviews for conditions of the retina and vitreous, followed by a 24-month outcome study of the SCORE 2 original randomized control study, and we'll end with the retrospective study looking at ranibizumab and aflibercept for age-related macular degeneration with a discussion of the impact of the FDA approval of brolucizumab. As always, a list of financial disclosures will be at the end of the episode. Remember that you can claim CME credits for this and other podcast episodes. Please click on the link in the episode description to direct yourself to the American Academy of Ophthalmology homepage. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with another Journal Club. In honor of Halloween, we have assembled the scariest team of retina specialists that you can find. In alphabetical order, Dr. M. Ali Khan of Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Ali, welcome back.
Thanks, Jay.
Next in alphabetical order, Dr. Priya Sharma from the D.C. area. Priya, welcome.
Thanks, Jay.
And last but not least, Dr. Yoshihiro Yonakawa from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Wills Eye Hospital. Yoshi?
Thanks, Jay.
I feel like you guys ever watch Around the Horn, Ali? We need, like, you know how, like, they all do, like, a five-second, like, thing? Like,
yeah.
Woody Page says something. I don't know if you, Priya and Yoshi, know you guys what we're talking about, but we
need to initiate. I have no idea what you're talking about.
You got to have like a five-second little thing you say. You get a little plug, but next time. Perfect. So, Journal Club, again, we're going to go through some major publications in major ophthalmology journals over the last month, and we pick these articles and go through them. The first article we're going to talk about is What Do Your Patients Think of You? An analysis of 84,230 physician review websites in ophthalmology published online in the journal Ophthalmology by Smith et al. Michael Singer was the senior author. Ali, you want to tell us a little bit about what they showed in this article?
So this was an article that basically looked at two of the most common online physician review websites, notably the ones in this article were HealthGrades and Vitals. And they basically searched for any reviews that were submitted for an ophthalmologist and then looked at the common ratings and the factors related to what those ratings might be. So they looked at different things like wait time, also gender, prior malpractice suits, if they had an academic appointment, and then basically looked at those to see if there's any correlation with the final rating.
And what were kind of the big takeaways?
Yeah, so the big takeaways from the article was that, first of all, for both websites, their reviews are actually pretty good. They the average rating was 4.16 between the two websites, and they're pretty equal. The overall findings that I think are not surprising is that shorter wait times correlated with a much higher average rating. They even had wait times less than 10 minutes. Those people had a score of 4.69 on average. People who had over an hour wait were significantly lower at 3.04. They also noted that people who were at academic institutions tended to have higher ratings than their private counterparts, and older age were actually correlated with a mild decrease in overall scores. But one thing that was actually something that a physician could intervene was that physicians who had a picture on their online profile or completed it on their website tended to have better ratings. So that was one thing that a physician could maybe do to improve their scores.
So Priya, you read this. You're a physician in a relatively new area, building your street cred. Online reviews are part of our life. They're part of the real world. And you know, first of all, besides the big take-home points for you, besides the fact that we definitely want a good picture on your website.
So, I mean, I think one of the positive things about this study is what Ali said, which is the average reviews are generally positive. And I think if anything, this really gives physicians the ability to have some control over what their online profile is. You think that ratings are out of your control, and you think that maybe disgruntled patients who have, you know, the typical complications that can happen in a retina practice would go on these websites, but that is not necessarily true. And it's empowering that you can actually improve your scores by doing things like writing a biography, decreasing wait time, even something as simple as putting on a photograph. So I think what this shows is that, if anything, it's worthwhile to give some time to your online profile to look at it and see what it looks like. And as you said, you know, this is super important in terms of building a practice, and not only that, but retaining patients and making sure that they have trust in you.
Yoshi, comments on your perspective, in terms of limitations, this is obviously observational. This is obviously just a couple of the websites in only a few areas in the United States, but I think that that's probably not a huge limitation, given that most patients and most people who do searches usually stick to the top hits. So anything else you wanted to point out?
I agree.
Study?
I think, they did a great job choosing the right websites. I think other limitations might be that this was all of ophthalmology and not just retina. And so it's unusual for any retina patient to have wait times less than 10 minutes. That's just crazy. The 20 largest metropolitan areas were targeted as study subjects. And so this may not be generalizable to suburban areas or rural areas, which will be interesting to look at in the future. So personally, I think, I'm going to be a bad borderline millennial and say that I kind of cringe a little bit sometimes when we talk about like online presence and online branding. I just don't like that kind of stuff. But it's, you mentioned, it's reality. This study is awesome that it gives us things that we can control for. I think it depends on the market, though. For example, if you're in a big group dominating the area, you may not be affected as much. But if you're in a high competition market, like in large cities, it probably matters a lot. And I think another aspect of this is that it does affect your ego also. And it would feel terrible to read a bad review when we work so hard to do what's best for patients after all the years of training, dedication, dedicating our lives and delaying our lives even. And you sort of get publicly shamed if you have a negative review. And so I think this is a whole different conversation, but this may be it may pertain to burnout also. And I think one way that we can mitigate the effects of negative reviews from disgruntled patients would be to have a lot of positive ones. And so one of my takeaways is that I think I'll probably start asking some of my patients to write positive reviews if they had a positive experience.
Those are great points. We do a course at Academy and ASRS each year on this subject, and I learn a lot by participating, but I also learn a lot from what people tell us and their experiences. And I think you hit the nail on the head. I think every field of ophthalmology is going to be very different. I think retina tends to be referral heavy. So maybe we're not advertising as directly to patients as some fields in ophthalmology, for example, like refractive surgery or cosmetic plastics. I do think that it's weird. Even though I do that course, and I do this podcast, I still also agree with you, Yoshi. I think we're both similar. We're kind of old school, where it's not really in our nature for most physicians to go and seek out, positive reviews. It's not really something that we are taught in medical school to advertise for ourselves. It feels almost like being too much of a salesman, and there is a business to medicine, but I think that everyone has kind of their comfort zone. But I think we can all agree, and Ali, you can comment a little bit. The big take home is, if you have to make sure whatever presence you have is at least professional and kind of matches what you want to portray. So even if you don't want to be, on Twitter or Instagram every day posting something to generate hits, like as long as your representation matches what you want to show to the world, then at least you're consistent with your values.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd be interested to know if the people who are more likely to have a full profile and put a picture on their website or on these websites are the same type of people who are more likely to solicit reviews from patients. It seems like it's it's self-fulfilling prophecy. If you're active on these websites, then maybe you're the one, maybe asking people to review you. And maybe that's more common in LASIK heavy or premium IOL heavy type ophthalmology practice, where advertising for non-insurance-based procedures is probably more competitive. I personally can't stand this kind of stuff, but I think it's more a discussion about it feeling not fair as a physician if you get a sort of a negative review that has something unrelated to you, or, you know, sometimes it's not the physician, it's the patient that's the problem, and vice versa, and you can't really control for that. So I know there are universities who are actually, the university is soliciting reviews of patients, and then their university is able to control which reviews are even, you know, visible and available to kind of combat some of these websites where you can essentially put whatever you want, and it's hard to necessarily verify what's real and what's not real. So I think, you know, there's going to come a point where we maybe need to defend, you know, ourselves from these types of reviews to make sure they're legitimate, et cetera. So I think there's, you know, a can of worms, of course, with this kind of thing, but this article definitely, you know, brings the topic up, I think, in a good academic way, and, you know, definitely food for thought based on how this discussion's going.
Bria, any thoughts on that? I'll let Yoshi close on this subject.
No, I thought that was all summarized well. You know, I think one of the important things to just kind of remember in these online reviews is it doesn't necessarily reflect quality of care, which is one of the frightening aspects. Is you can have someone who's a fantastic retina surgeon or fantastic clinician and have terrible reviews. But unfortunately, this is sometimes what our patients are looking at. So, you know, I think I agree with what Ali said. It's not a fun thing to do and isn't necessarily fair, but it's something that unfortunately our patients are using as their metric to see what they believe is good quality of care.
And before Yoshi closes, that's a great point. But I think it's really, really challenging as a patient / consumer to really evaluate quality of care, right? It's really difficult without having a personal connection, word of mouth, something like that. I tend to value those things a lot. When I'm a patient, you know, in fields that I'm not as familiar with, you know, a colleague, someone who's recommended, because it can be really challenging to tell how good somebody is. We all know this being within our own field, and they're excellent people who may just not, maybe they have zero ratings. It doesn't correlate, as you said. So it's being a patient in medicine, reviews don't help, but there aren't other really good ways. You know, there's rankings and things like that, but they're not necessarily based on the quality of individual providers rather than a hospital system. So it really varies what you're having done. If you're going to be an inpatient, but if you just want like an outpatient procedure, like most ophthalmology patients have, it can be tough to kind of tell who's good without, you know, word of mouth or a personal connection. Right, Yoshi?
Yeah, exactly. So just to, I guess, close this conversation, you know, this sucks. It's reality. I really congratulate the authors for providing material that we can really work on. I think my approach is going to be try to express empathy as much as possible, be efficient, but don't cut corners. And I think as long as we do what's right for the patient, we'll be okay. These are little things that we can kind of pick up and learn from. And I think it was a good article. I hope there'll be more like it coming out.
Well, the next article we're going to talk about is evaluation of systematic reviews of interventions for retina and vitreous condition. This was an original investigation published in JAMA Ophthalmology by Lay et al. With Lee as the senior author. Priya, you want to tell us a little bit about this article, what they set out to show, and what the results were?
Yeah, sure. So this article aimed to summarize the reliability of systematic reviews on 7 retina vitreous conditions. The 7 conditions were conditions that are being targeted by the American Academy of Ophthalmology for their next preferred practice patterns. And they basically include macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, epiretinal membrane VMT, macular hole, PVD, retinal breaks, artery occlusions, and retinal vein occlusion. And so what the study team did is they basically looked at systematic reviews. They identified 327 systematic reviews of these conditions. And then they wanted to basically identify if these reviews were reliable or if they were unreliable. And to do this, they looked at a couple of different criteria. They looked to see if they defined their eligibility criteria for selecting them in the study. They looked to see if they conducted a comprehensive literature search and not only conducted it, but if they described how they did it, if they reported how they assessed for bias in their studies, And then if they described any other methods for meta-analysis performed, and then conclusions were consistent with the review findings. And what they found is out of these 327 systematic reviews, only 131 of these, or 40%, were classified as reliable, whereas 196, or around 60%, were classified as not reliable. And what the author said is that the main reason that they deemed a review unreliable was lack of evidence that a comprehensive literature search had been done. And so if they had done a literature search, but they didn't describe it or use the metrics that that they felt, you know, if they didn't collaborate with informational professionals and use a certain strategy that could be replicated, then they felt that it was an unreliable review. And so, you know, the reason that this matters is that it's helpful to use this to basically reflect on what these reviews are to determine if we can deem them reliable or unreliable, regardless of the journal or regardless of who publishes them.
So Yoshi, you're a very, very rigorous and systematic review of articles. You have served as editor of some journals. What is this? I mean, this is very interesting results, and you know, it's kind of a little sobering to think about this and realize, you know, just because something is published in a journal doesn't mean that necessarily it's quote unquote reliable.
Right. Absolutely. And so I think I just want to take a step back and just define some of these terms. So we talk about systematic reviews, we talk about meta-analyses, we talk about literature reviews also. And here we're not talking about literature reviews, but literature reviews is probably the most commonly performed. And you sort of do whatever. You collect papers, hopefully in a predetermined way, but you summarize the data yourself however you want. A systematic review is what the authors are talking about, is when you have a predetermined question, you identify studies with set criteria, and then you undergo a meta-analysis. So the meta-analysis is the statistical method where you combine the numbers together from multiple studies. And we may remember that the triangle of levels of evidence, where you have case reports and small retrospective case series all the way at the bottom. Then you move up a little bit. You have cohort studies. You move up a little bit. You have prospective studies, small RCTs, and large randomized clinical trials. And all the way at the top is the systematic review. And it's kind of concerning that we kind of suck at doing that. And only 40% seems to be acceptable, which was kind of concerning. And this current paper itself is a systematic review also, I think. And
right.
This has a 40% chance of being okay. And So I think we have to be really careful about how we...
If a paper that says that 40% of meta-analyses are unreliable has a 40% chance of being unreliable, then what does the first data point mean?
Yes.
But
yeah, we have to be very careful about reading this paper. You know, one thing that I found really interesting, it was just mentioned as a passing in the paper, but the authors noted that about half of the systematic reviews ever written in ophthalmology was published in the past 5 years. And so we also have an explosion of a lot of journals out there, a lot of data, and it's really incredible how much data is available now. But we also have to, you know, this paper shows us clearly that we have to be very careful about interpreting data. And I think, you know, they're finding that the most common unmet criterion one was the lack of how the comprehensive literature review was performed. And basically, a lot of papers just don't try hard enough to find all the papers. And for people who really want to do this, it's very tough doing a systematic review. Mm-hmm. But there are certain guidelines out there. I forgot the names, but if you look them up, there are reporting guidelines for how to write and report systematic reviews. So you should follow that. And one wish that I have for the authors is that it would be a great service if they would just list all the reviews that they went over and mark which ones are good or bad. But I was just thinking after our discussion that's very similar to like writing online Yelp reviews of the authors. So let's not encourage that.
No. And Ali, I want to get your thoughts as well. But one thing I just want to mention, you know, I think that many medical schools, and I don't know if it's mandatory, include some sort of classes on evidence-based medicine, PICO searches, the triangle of evidence, as you talked about, Yoshi, the how to conduct the meta-analysis, search strategies, things like that. And ironically, just like it is throughout our schooling, everyone's least favorite classes end up being probably the most useful, while our favorite classes end up being the most useless. Similar to my dislike of foreign languages in high school, this was probably one of the classes that everyone hated, but we probably carried the most weight. And, you know, Ali, I want you to comment too, but I think Yoshi, you did a really good job defining those terms, because I think that a literature review versus a systematic review, completely different, and completely different when you're thinking as an author. And I think a lot of times when I have medical students who I'm working with who want to write papers, or residents, those are very different sort of undertakings in terms of rigor and sort of the work that has to go into really doing good meta-analysis, systematic review. It's not so simple, and that's why they get published really well, and that's why this got published in a very strong journal. You know, Ali, I think part of the issue too is that, unfortunately, the majority of readers, and I can say sometimes this happens to me, and I feel like I'm at least average educated for ophthalmology, it's just hard sometimes to digest a systematic review or meta-analysis and really understand everything that was done. And sometimes it can be a little obscure to when you're reading methods to kind of understand the search strategy. And so that shouldn't be true for a good meta-analysis or systematic review, because again, just like everything in the scientific method, it should be reproducible if you did the search yourself. So I don't know, any thoughts on that and other thoughts on this paper?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the authors noted that they're not commenting on the, you know, the substance of the reviews, you know, even if they were reliable or not reliable, whether they came to the right conclusion was not really what they're calling reliable or unreliable. It's not the actual conclusions, but rather the methodology and the statistics, honestly. And I honestly do think that many ophthalmologists and many med students, like you mentioned, Dave, we're weak at that when it's beyond simple, you know, t-tests and things you can run on a free online calculator by yourself. But when it comes to systematic reviews and meta-analyses, that's a different layer of statistics that I don't think, you know, I don't feel fully comfortable with. We always rely on the statistician to help us through it. But, you know, when we're the ones writing these articles, you know, one of the main recommendations from the authors was that teams should collaborate with information professionals knowledgeable about performing systematic reviews. They're basically saying, ask somebody who actually knows what they're talking about before you publish this to make sure it's reliable. So I think it's just kind of a little bit of a wake-up call to remind people, hey, there is actually a reason why these types of articles are at the tip of the evidence pyramid, and we should maybe be following those guidelines before calling it a systematic review or a meta-analysis. And if these are the basis for those preferred practice patterns publications from the American Academy of Ophthalmology, that's even more important that we get it right. So I think that ultimately is the right message that they're coming across. Whether or not that's easy or not is the real question. So, you know, I never took kind of library science per se, statistics level courses at any point in my education, and you know, I've never really wanted to be honest. But I think if you're trying to do this kind of work, it's important to not only do it for the authors, but for anyone who's actually reading it. You know, we should know more about how these reviews even come about. And honestly, I don't feel like I'm very good at that. So this article, what I took away from it is, you know, maybe I do need to learn more about that part of the process rather than just skimming to the end for the conclusions from the Cochrane database to tell me what the answer is. You get what I mean?
Yeah. Priya, any final thoughts on this paper before we move forward?
I agree with everything that was said. And the one other thing that I will say that this study didn't look at is if any of the conclusions that are made are still relevant. It's possible that some of the reviews they looked at are out of date, but they would have still classified them as reliable if their scientific method was robust. So that's also an important grain of salt, is that just because it was reliable here doesn't mean it's still accurate.
Perfect. Well, moving forward, JAMA Ophthalmology had another publication called MUNT24 Outcomes After Treatment Initiation with Anti-VEGF Therapy for Macular Edema Due to CR or Hemiretinal Vein Occlusion. This is the SCORE 2 Report 10, and a secondary analysis of the SCORE 2 trial. Ingrid Scott was the senior author for the SCORE 2 investigator group. Ali, just want to quickly summarize what they looked at 2 years and what are kind of the big takeaways?
Yeah, basically this is a longer-term follow-up of the SCORE 2 study, which compared patients initially receiving bevacizumab or aflibercept for either CRVO or HRVO. And, you know, there's a specific treatment criteria through month 6 and then after month 6 as well for responders and non-responders in each group. So the purpose of this report was looking at at the patients who received either aflibercept or bevacizumab at the start of the study, what were their outcomes at 24 months, regardless of what happened essentially between month 6 and month 24. So they summarized those findings with a few caveats, one being that they did not have necessarily a high retention rate of all of these patients. Only 65% of the participants actually made it to month 24. And also that between month 12 and month 24, they note that the physicians could treat the patients however they wanted with any drug, whether it was in the study or not. But they still analyzed the final results based on the initial drug they received. And ultimately, they noted that there were no differences in their score or central macular thickness outcomes at month 24 for those patients who were originally assigned to aflibercept or bevacizumab, but noted all those caveats I just mentioned.
Priya, your thoughts and reactions, how does this influence the any way in your way of practice? We've talked about score 2 in the past, now we have longer follow-up. Any thoughts on aflibercept, bevacizumab, how you kind of do your algorithms when you see a patient?
I think the study shows that, you know, bevacizumab is not inferior to aflibercept for the treatment of vein occlusion, macular edema associated with vein occlusion. So I think it just reinforces the fact that you can safely treat with bevacizumab. I think one of the things, you know, as with all studies to keep in mind here is the outcomes worsen in year 2 when the investigators are able to treat as per their discretion. And so that's definitely something important to keep in mind. Perhaps we are still under-treating at year 2, or under-treating in general once they're off of a study protocol, but it does support the choice of drug, whether it's bevacizumab or aflibercept.
Yeah, so I thought, you know, this is a very important study, but the main paper is the six-month outcomes. And I think the protocol sort of became very unregimented after that. Actually, there was no protocol, and physicians they were able to do whatever. Even if you had snowbirds who traveled elsewhere to get injections, those injections still counted. And so I think the data reliability is a little lacking, especially since the follow-up rate was not that great. And so you may argue that this is, hey, a little more real world, but it's difficult to make sense of the data because it's not really the real world data. It's still part of a clinical trial. And the authors stand by their six-month outcomes that Avastin, bevacizumab is non-inferior to Eylea based on vision. But there was more edema at 6 months in the Avastin arm. 24 months, it kind of regressed to the mean. But we're not really sure how to make of the data personally, is my opinion. And does it change my practice patterns? Probably not. Because, you know, currently I'm using all the medication, Avastin, Eylea, Lucentis, Ozurdex, depending on the patient, what their insurance is, and personally, I think it's important to have as many options as possible because the patients in front of us are not clinical trial patients and they're all unique. And I feel like the treatment should be tailored to the individual patient. But like Priya mentioned, I think in general, treatment is good, similar to many other extension studies where you just the visual outcomes plummet as soon as you stop injecting.
Yeah, I think that's been showed, like you said, in other studies. And Priya, you mentioned that as well. And I think there's just real human factors for that. Part of it is probably patients. A lot of it is probably us. I think that at some point, I think no matter what people think, and most physicians don't want to keep treating patients what we feel is quote unquote excessively. We want to feel like we're making progress. And so we try to extend these patients. And the CRVO and the HRVO patients behave like the CRVO patients. CRVO patients just don't seem to have the same sort of ability to either come off treatment or extend as BRVO patients. There's not really a good head-to-head, but kind of just looking, extrapolating trial results that have looked at both of those groups over time, it's just a different disease condition. And we don't know if the vision loss is because of the under-treatment, though there's some correlation. We just don't know if that some of it's vascular remodeling and increased disorganization that happens later, like drill. But again, like you said, an important paper. This is a limited study. This is an extension study, but these extension studies are always interesting. As you said, they're not regimented. This is not the original randomized control trial, but they still do give us some data points. Ali, any final thoughts on this?
No, I think, you know, they kind of compared two groups up to month 6, kind of in a very regimented protocol. And then after month 6 to 12 was different protocol. And then month 12 to 24 was a free for all in a way. So I kind of agree with what Yoshi mentioned, that it does make it hard to know exactly what the data means, but certainly at 24 months, you know, both groups didn't do terribly, which is, I guess, a good thing, but maybe suggests we need to know more about longer-term follow-ups in CRVO patients in a maybe more regimented way to assess further what outcomes we're really looking for and if we can really compare the differences between drugs.
You know, you guys have been super generous with your time. We're running a little over, but I'm just going to quickly run through this last article. It's called Treatment Outcomes of Ranibizumab versus Aflibercept for Neovascular Age-Related Macular Degeneration. This is data from the Fighting Retinal Blindness Registry by Bhandari et al. And this is data from Australia as well as some analysis from New Zealand. And so again, just to summarize, what they did is they looked at retrospective data from this large database of patients over about 2 years and basically looked at 965 eyes, which is large, relatively large, not huge for a retrospective study. And the big take home points was at three years inclusive, that the CNVs in terms of activity, in terms of macular thickness, in terms of visual acuity change, there really was no difference between the groups. There was a slightly higher proportion of patients who were switched to aflibercept from ranibizumab than vice versa, but there were no huge differences between the groups. And again, just threw this in as a fourth, not only in honor of our four-person journal club, but just again, another study kind of showing that there really isn't a huge difference between these medications. And also, since we haven't talked about it in a podcast episode, again, brolucizumab should have been called Brolo or Brolia, but its BOV was approved by the FDA just a couple weeks ago for the treatment of wet age-related macular degeneration. So Yoshi, you talked about options. We have even more options for wet AMD than we had before. And this study at least seems to confirm that we have two options that have worked really well and have a proven track record. And hopefully now we have a third on-label option in addition to off-label bevacizumab. Yoshi, any thoughts on this paper and then BioView's approval?
So this registry study, it was not the strongest paper, I think. Registry studies are a lot of fun to do. It's a great effort. One of the things I love about research is, you know, bringing collaborators together. In fact, I think all four of us have written papers together. And for this study, I think the weakest thing is that inclusion of patient data is voluntary, so the cases can be cherry-picked. It's not really a real-world study either. And of the big data types of papers, you have registries and claim-based studies and EMR, high-risk registry-based studies. These tend to be, I think, methodologically speaking, the most limited. And so I'm personally not sure if I learned too much from the paper besides, you know, having good options for treating wet AMD. And I agree with you, more the better, and we'll see what the clinical efficacy is in the real world for bevacizumab, and I'm definitely looking forward to it being available.
Ali, thoughts on bevacizumab, this paper?
I think paper kind of another one of those real world that show that maybe we are under-treating. You know, the letter gains with both drugs at year three were not really that great, maybe 0.3 to 1.6, I think, letter is gained, which is they're definitely not what we see in the phase three studies for the same drug. So whatever factors are going into that under treatment, I think deserve further study to find out why, perhaps. But just makes me think again, are we really under treating or are we on track? I think BioView, I think that's how you pronounce it. I think it'll be interesting to see how that drug now comes in the market. I believe it's the same price as a aflibercept, from what I understand. From a, you know, cost perspective, it looks like it won't be potentially that much of a difference from what we currently have in terms of branded drug. But how we assess, you know, differential response in the real world will be interesting, especially with the quote-unquote 12-week interval dosing potentially achievable with BioView. So I think there'll be a lot of switch studies, a lot of real-world treatment-naive studies coming out, which will.
Priya, your thoughts?
I think that with BioView, there, you know, is a potential for longer-acting therapy. But, you know, I will say that in all of these studies, everything, you know, ranibizumab, aflibercept, bevacizumab, they've all kind of been non-inferior to each other. So I am a little skeptical whether bevacizumab is going to all of a sudden dramatically change things. I think if anything, maybe we can get a longer treatment effect. But, you know, I'm excited to see what it looks like. But, you know, I'm also cautiously skeptical that it's going to make a huge difference. I think, you know, we have some great treatment options right now, and we're trying to make things that are really good even better, which is definitely very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Great point and great job. And no Novartis dinners for Priya Sharma in the near future. I'm just kidding. No, none of us are direct consultants for Novartis. I think Alcon, Yoshi and I do some Alcon stuff, but a different division. But I agree. I'm just not going to let you hang on that branch. I think we all kind of represent. We'll have to wait and see. Real world data, we'll see. Maybe we get a little longer duration. I think for me, the patients who would be good candidates are the patients who have tried the other three medications at this point and still have persistent disease activity. I mean, those are, for me, the initial patients to try a new medication on. But we will wait and see what the results are. We'll have some more data, hopefully, once people start using it. So, guys, thank you so much for staying up late here on the East Coast. Ali, you're on East Coast time now, which has to be painful for your West Coast soul. So maybe you're feeling pretty good right now.
Yeah, Laker games start in like 4 minutes, so it's pretty tough.
It's okay. Lakers aren't doing anything this year anyway. It's okay. You should just get on the Sixers bandwagon while you're there. Have a wonderful Halloween, Ali, Yoshi. Hopefully you're taking the kids out. Kid in your case, Ali. Kids for Yoshi.
Many kids.
Mine will be asleep, but we'll dress them up no matter what.
Beautiful. Guys, have a wonderful night. Thank you for doing this, and hopefully we'll have you back soon. This is a powerhouse. It was really impressive. Take care.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry.
As always, you can find this episode and all other episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's RETINAPodcast.com. All 198 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You will also find our blog, Equal Rapid and Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. Here's a huge update. Remember, you can claim CME credits for select podcasts via the AAO website. Simply log in as an AAO member and click on the link in the episode description. On our website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the Apple Podcast Store as well as the Android Store. You can also find us on Facebook or in the Apple Podcast Store or Android Store on your mobile device. We're on Twitter at retinapodcast.com, and to contact us, click on the contact us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love getting feedback on things we can do better and things we're already doing well. As we reach episode 200, that's especially important heading into now our fourth year of doing these podcasts. We appreciate anyone subscribed via iTunes or Android Store or Apple Store to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to In Order, Dr. Khan, Dr. Sharma, and Dr. Yonakawa for joining me for this journal club. Thanks to the dream team of producers for this episode, Dr. Louis Kai and Dr. Angela Chang, as well as Dr. Michael Benicasa, who handles our social media. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. Stay safe during this Halloween holiday. We'll be back for Monday with the Retinal Physician November-December preview. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.